Welcome to the Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and this is the private equity episode. We've done a bunch of segments on private equity, whether it's housing, healthcare, elder care, daycare, K-12. And in some of those segments, I've been kind of skeptical of the role of private equity. And we have a listener who works within the industry, close to the private equity industry, is a huge expert. He sent me a message online and said, hey, like, if you ever want anybody on to offer a different perspective on private equity, I'm here. And I've welcomed him on. And he and I, Matt, his name is Matt Checkman, he'll be on in a little bit to talk about his experience with private equity. And I think he gives a nuanced take that's more positive than I've been on private equity. And I think that's really valuable because we are the Lost Debate after all. I then talked to Carrie Sun, who wrote a best-selling memoir called Private Equity that recently came out. She worked for a hedge fund / private equity fund / hybrid fund and wrote all about her experience working as the assistant to the person who ran that firm and then her decision to leave. My intention in that conversation was to talk all about private equity, but actually because we had both had similar experiences as assistants to sort of powerful people, we spent most of that conversation talking about what it's like being an assistant. And that sort of, it turned into a little bit of a Devil Wears Prada in real life segment, which I actually think is far more entertaining than how we planned to spend the time. And so stick around for that. But just the warning is it's a little bit lighter than the Matt conversation on hardcore private equity issues and is way more, I would say, juicy when it comes to details of just like, what is it like to work in a job like that? And I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. But before we get to either of those, I need a favor. And I really mean this one. If you listen to this podcast and you're a loyal listener, I rarely ask you for anything. We have been nominated, which means we're kind of like finalists, for the award called the Webby Award, which is kind of like the Oscars of podcasts, in the category of limited series and specials and news and politics. And we're finalists for our coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, particularly the unbiased histories that I've done, which I know so many of you have listened to. A lot of you, you came to this podcast because of those episodes. They're our most listened to episodes we've ever had. And it would mean so much to me. Voting closes in 2 days. If you would go online and vote for us for that category, it will take you less than a minute. Yes, you have to kind of sign in using your Gmail or whatever account you want, but then you could immediately, after you vote, sign up for whatever it is. And we're in the running. And so we would love to win that award. It means a lot to us. They have both an audience award and then a selection pick. So go vote for that. We're going to put it in the show notes. And you can find it anywhere just by going to Webby and looking up limited series and specials of news and politics, and you'll find us. You only have to vote for one thing. You don't have to vote for all the other stuff. And it would really help. So go out and do that. With that, let's jump in. Well, I'm excited to welcome on one of our listeners who's so much more than a listener. It's Matt Checkman, who's managing partner of Long Angle Incorporated, whose mission is to help the next generation of high net worth investors successfully navigate just the world of investment and their lives. And Matt reached out to me because we've been talking about private equity quite a bit. We talked about it in the school setting. We talked about it in the housing setting. We talked about it in the healthcare setting. And as we noted recently, I can't even remember which episode this was, we tend to take like a bit of a negative valence on private equity, as I think most media does. And I'm not sure Matt is necessarily like pro-private equity, but he certainly, I think, can represent the sort of arguments in favor of private equity probably better than I could or any of our guests yet have. And so I wanted to welcome him on because he has like a perfect level of experience to talk about this. So Matt, first of all, thank you for being a listener and thanks for making the time for us today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to be here. It's good to put a face to the voice.
I really appreciate you reaching out because we just had a conversation that we're going to air on the back end of this episode with the woman, Carrie Sun, who wrote the book Private Equity, which is a memoir of working in, among other things, private equity. And I spent the beginning of that interview trying to like figure out, okay, what is private equity versus hedge fund versus venture capital? What's the overlap? What's the scope here? And I don't think we quite landed the plane well on that. So if you could help us just define some terms here, what are the differences between these different types of investment vehicles and firms?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. And you can go pretty deep into this, but at a high level, it's actually not particularly complicated. You know, all the companies that you're familiar with in the public markets, Apple, Google, Meta, naming off the tech ones, but in general, those are public companies. They went public, they're public equities, and they have filing and notice requirements, and they're traded on public markets, your NASDAQ, your S&P, et cetera. The private equity is really nothing different than it's not traded on a public market. And there's some different SEC oversight attached to it. But really, it's just those companies are not owned by public shareholders. They're owned by private shareholders, which is often a large private equity company, but it can come in a variety of forms. Technically, you know, Long Angle, the company that I'm a partner at, we are private equity. We're privately owned. We just don't have a sponsor backer like your Carlyles and KKRs and Apollos, et cetera. And then you can get into the world of venture and real estate and all those types of things, which is really just varying levels of private equity. Venture being, this is an unproven company. It may not be profitable yet. We're going to try and make it 10, 20 years and actually take it public and have a liquidity event, you know, real estate and some other things, just different variations of that mix. But, you know, on its face, it's actually a pretty simple distinction.
And is venture capital a subset of private equity? Because those are usually not companies that are publicly traded, obviously, because they're just starting off.
Correct. It's just a different stage in the life cycle. So typically in the private equity spectrum, you have your venture, which is the very beginning. Maybe you have an idea. Then series A, B, C, the idea turns into revenue. Maybe there's some light at the end of the tunnel. Then there's growth equity, which is sort of the in-between your private equity and your venture capital, which is, this is probably going to be your last fundraising event or, you know, your first institutional money in outside of the founder's capital. And then what people typically think of in terms of private equity is your leveraged buyouts. This is the big boogeyman sort of thing where you have companies, typically large profitable companies, changing hands from Apollo and KKR and Carlyle and Ares and Blackstone and all of those. And they get a little bit more notoriety probably because those are the large transactions. They can be take privates. They can be entirely private transactions, but, you know, often well into the billions.
So just to set up the sort of contrast here, you know, people like me, people like our listeners, when we make investment decisions, there's a pretty standard playbook, which is diversify, usually using public equities and bonds and maybe some other vehicles, but usually a combination of those two things. And there's like a formula that has been tried and true around how old you are, how many years you are away from retirement. People are constantly revisiting it, but it's not very complicated. And the very sound advice that makes a lot of sense is, unless you're a professional, and even if you are a professional, you're probably better off just using an index fund and forgetting about it. When it comes to high net worth individuals, institutions, and, you know, even like universities, which are a huge player here, why do they, and when I was talking about talking to the author of the Ray Dalio book, we were talking about this a little bit, which is, why don't they just do the same thing we all do, and then there's no fees or anything like that? Like, why do all this other stuff? Is there just way, are there better returns on the other side of the rainbow, or are there other institutional reasons why they might want to diversify beyond the way that a typical individual would?
Yeah, if you were talking to, you know, a pension or endowment, they probably have a list of 10 or 12 things of which, you know, have varying levels of veracity to them. But it usually comes down to two things typically, which is diversification, which is sort of a mix of saying the same thing with respect to limited correlation to public markets, and then outperformance. And outperformance isn't always a truism. And I think that there's an acknowledgement that outperformance happens sometimes, and it's great when it does, but that's not the main goal. The main goal is to limit volatility and to prevent black swan type events in your portfolio. And there's a number of studies, if you wanted to look at them, of, you know, your Yale endowments and Harvard and those that have very, very large endowments. They don't typically outperform the S&P, except they're much, much smoother. And so the way that you do this is with asset mixes that have limited correlation to each other. Now, there are plenty of managers that have outperformed for a very long time. And there's a lot of reasons why that happens, from information asymmetry, capital dislocations, small markets with limited access, those types of things. And they're just not efficient and traded on the public markets. The thing that's interesting about public markets versus private over the last 20 or 30 years or so is that public markets actually make up a very, very small portion of your investment pool. So if I'm just a lay investor, I have $5 million in assets, so to speak, of you're squarely in the high net worth range, but you're definitely not in an endowment of, okay, well, what am I trying to do? And you put all of your net worth into public stocks and public bonds, that's a very, very small slice of the overall US economy or international economy, if you wanted to look at it. And so people, they get uncomfortable with, okay, historically, and when you're looking at the Trinity studies and things like that, that say investing in indexes is the way to go, that's actually a fairly limited time horizon, right? You're really talking about a few decades. And within those few decades, some really weird things happened, like inflation in the 70s and, you know, crazy interest rates at the same time. You had wars, you had different things that affected your GDP and overall spending. The US's debt spending or debt to income and debt to GDP has ballooned. And so things are just different. And so relying on those things to say indexes outperform always, and so just do that no matter what, people get a little bit worried about it. And so then they try to smooth that volatility and mix in with assets that have limited correlation to the public markets.
And so the industry has evolved, obviously. And where we are today, based on some of the sort of segments we've done, is that it seems like what we traditionally call private equity firms are all over the place in America. They're dominant in the healthcare industry, buying up hospitals and doctors' practices, something we established. They're buying up daycare centers. They're buying up elder care centers, et cetera. It feels like this is a sort of subset of it, right? Like there's like traditional sort of, you know, more sort of scaled companies. And then there's almost like something on the order of medium-sized businesses and even mom and pops. Has private equity always been involved in the latter, or is that like a relatively new trend?
Relatively new trend, and it's pretty sector focused. Like there just aren't very many private equity companies going and buying up the HVAC company that I use in order to fix my air conditioning unit. It's just hard. It's difficult to scale, et cetera. But you've seen it in certain types of businesses, like you mentioned, in healthcare, in the dentist doctor roll up is pretty big. And it tends to be a little bit sector specific. But I would push back a little bit on this assumption that private equity is taking over all small businesses. And I don't know that that's exactly what you're saying, but I do hear that type of thing. And we just don't see it happening for a lot of structural reasons. Not saying they wouldn't if they could.
It's just hard to gobble up, right? That many businesses, right? Like, it seems like it's more, like you said, if I implied that, hopefully I didn't, but it seems like it's more of a thing in certain industries, right? Like when we're talking about like doctor's practices, I think is the classic example of it. I think daycare is another example of it, where my sense is, and you know better than I do, they look at certain industries, they sit around and they're like, all right, this industry, there's a huge benefit. First of all, there's like steady returns. Healthcare is an example of that. Probably increased returns given increased spending in some of these areas, although healthcare is complicated based on some of the stuff that we've been covering recently. And we can build expertise in that area, right? Because like, there's one thing if I'm like, oh, okay, I'm going to buy some laundromats, I'm going to buy some healthcare practice, some daycare. You can't really run a firm with that level of complexity, but you could be like, all right, I'm going to hire a bunch of physicians and former hospital administrators and economists, and we're going to go billions into the healthcare industry, and we're going to be experts on this one industry. That seems like how it goes, right? Like these super diverse institutions probably are much harder to pull off.
Yeah, they tend to target areas where they can scale, but also, I mean, this isn't going to be surprising, but it's incentive driven, right? Where they see gaps in the market and that need to be fulfilled. And I think that is kind of a truism across a lot of these hot button topics, is that there are issues within these subsectors. You look at childcare, massive undersupply issues for a whole host of reasons. So it's not particularly surprising that private equity can come in. They have relatively inelastic pricing and they know that there is going to be steady demand. And frankly, it's just hard. It's just a hard industry. You have constant staffing turnover, HR, you've got liability issues and those types of things.
Huge regulation, yeah.
Yeah, and so mom and pops can struggle with that type of thing. And so they see a gap in the market, but it's consistent with housing undersupplied, healthcare. I don't know specific to hospital and sort of your general practitioners and stuff. But we just went through a roll-up exercise with a dental private equity firm, huge undersupply of dentists. And so they see these types of things and they're coming into the market because there's a gap, not necessarily because they're just, oh, well, what we're going to try and do is we're going to, you know, gouge this particular space because we can. It's because there are other structural issues within the US infrastructure and economy that we need to look at.
Yeah. And so like, let's kind of line up the arguments for and against private equity, right? So on the against side of things, which we've done in a lot of segments, it's, you talk about the sort of leverage buyout model of private equity, right? Which in certain sectors, there will be debt-driven acquisitions that, you know, the nursing home industry being an example of this, where the bill comes due and then they wind up selling the underlying assets or something like that. And like the service quality decreases. So that's one critique of private equity. A second critique is consolidation in and of itself can create issues like sort of regional monopolies and things like that. That's a criticism on the healthcare industry, for example, where if a private equity firm owns all the doctors' practices in the hospitals in an area, they can control the prices. Third thing is I just think people don't trust people sitting in big towers buying up small things generally. I think it's kind of a vibes thing. Am I missing any other sort of main critiques of private equity before I move on to, oh, and then short-term profits, right? There's this sense that so they're not, and I this is definitely seems industry specific, that some a lot of these cases, they're not intending to hold on to these institutions long-term. And so they're not thinking long-term about the health of these companies. And I'm not saying all these are true. I'm saying these are the critiques that I commonly hear. Is there any that we're missing before we kind of talk about the pros and or answers to those?
Yeah, I think so. And I would push back on some of the ones that you said, not because it's not accurate in terms of where the critiques tend to lie, but that I think the presumption and the assumptions made about private equity and that it is true to the industry as a whole that we can make generalizations from is not necessarily accurate. I think the biggest issues tends to be with consolidation and size. It has an outsized effect on your overall power in the industry, and it can affect lobbying. And we talked about a few minutes ago that there are structural issues within these sectors that I wouldn't attribute to private equity. I think we have supply issues in housing. I think we have child care issues. I think it's a stain on the US that we do not have public child care starting at age one, like we do starting at kindergarten. But that's not private equity's fault, right? And so we have these structural issues, but if you have an organization that gets too large, the lobbying efforts based on our current political system can prevent the change that otherwise would be needed that we should probably be pointing towards. So I think that that is a big one, which ties into what you mentioned in terms of just consolidated size and potential, your traditional antitrust or monopolistic sort of tendencies. And then I think the big one is private equity. They're very good at efficiency. That is what they're built to do, whether it's financial efficiency, operational efficiency, execution, et cetera. There are certain public goods where you shouldn't be optimizing for costs or those types of things. And again, I don't say that that's private equity's fault. That's just incentives driven. And so when you're pointing to private equity as the boogeyman, you're letting off Apple. You're letting off other public or even private, the mom and pop owner down the street that is really doing a bad job and they're not listening to their customers because you don't have appropriate regulations in place or you don't have the right incentive structures. And so there are things that are specific to private equity that you should watch out for. But the things like I've heard of, you know, private equity comes in and they suck a company dry and then they leave a dead carcass on the road, right? Like this is a trope. It's just not true. Like there's no benefit in a private equity company to do something like that or to over leverage and put 90% debt.
Right. The only case for that would be in a case like, and I have no idea how true this is. So I'm just going to use this as an example. I remember when one of these companies took over the Tennessean newspaper, the Tennessean had an amazing facility in downtown Nashville. I don't actually know if what I'm about to say is true, but the sort of presumption was they come in, they're buying the newspaper, not because they care about journalism or the newspaper, because they love the building. And so then they sell the building and then cut the staff. And that's what people are worried about. And I don't even, and again, I have no idea whether that's actually true of that industry. It feels to me like that has to be a minority of situations, because most of the time, the value of a business is to sustain itself, right? Unless it's particularly sitting on particularly valuable assets that are more valuable than the services.
You know, at the end of the day, private equity has to report to shareholders just like a public equity company does. If they're not producing returns and they're just killing these businesses that just go into bankruptcy every single time that they do them, they're not going to be in business anymore. You know, we look at a lot of private equity firms and they have loss ratios in the sub 5% range. And we also, I mean, something to consider, especially when you're talking about leverage buyouts and this kind of long running assumption that they just put massive loads of debt on, their debt is actually not particularly high on average. I think in the last few years, it's been an average of about 50% of the asset value. That means if they're doing a $10 billion transaction, they're putting $5 billion of their own money into it. They have no incentive to destroy this company. They have every incentive to grow it, make it better, and then sell it to the next party down the road or take it public, et cetera. I mean, I can't speak to the Tennessean example. And, you know, there are bad actors in anything. And so I think where I come from is if there are issues, I think we're getting distracted by pointing to this boogeyman of private equity that is letting certain other things off the hook. And it's avoiding the underlying issues that may affect everyone that's just tied to the incentives when they're running a business. That could be a private investor, it could be a private equity company, it could be a public company, or you know, the initial founders who started something.
Yeah, and so to catalog now, like this sort of arguments in favor of private equity, generally speaking, there are sort of sector-specific arguments, right? Like when we talked about housing, the main argument that the articles were pointing to in the housing market when they talk about single family homes is that the private equity firms are buying up houses in more distressed neighborhoods and fixing them up when nobody else is going to fix them up and renting them out when rentals were in short supply or high quality rentals or safe rentals. So there's sector specific issues here. And then there's sort of general trends. And I think the big one I'm hearing you say is scale, right? Like you take childcare, for example, we don't have enough. Single site operators aren't popping up fast enough for many reasons, including regulation, right? The private equity firms can swoop in and because of their sheer size and scale can expand these operations. And two, and this is double-edged sword though, right? But like there's a positive part of this, which is they are better at dealing with regulation than you or I or me and the average person would be. And so they're likely to cut through the red tape faster than somebody else. They're likely to have better lawyers, et cetera. So whereas like your sort of medium-sized operator may open 5 daycare centers in 5 years, the private equity firm may open 50, like if they have the right team in place. And yes, there are issues you could point to there and write the article about like the slide in scale of the 50th daycare center versus the 10th, but also there is a 50th in that case in which there might be a demand for that. And that is a plus in a lot of markets.
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's the consistency thing. I mean, you could apply it to a lot of things, but people like going to McDonald's or Chick-fil-A because they know what they're going to get every single time, no matter where they are. When we moved to Bend from Atlanta several years ago with 2 small children, I would say there is nothing short of a childcare crisis in Central Oregon. And that's not unique to us. I mean, that is kind of a rural or outside of metro area issue. And an interesting anecdote, right, is where we were going to put our kids for daycare, the owner absconded and embezzled the funds, never to be seen of again. And the way, because it's so entrenched with massive, massive undersupply and over demand, they were taking 1 year, 2 year deposits in advance and then absconding. So some of the arguments of, well, private equity has no liability, you know, you can't even sue anybody at the end of the day. I mean, it's not accurate, but I look at those types of things and I'm like, no, I want somebody to be there when I'm putting a deposit down that I know I can go get it back from, not this person who I don't know if they're following the right regulations, if they're hiring people, if they're paying them under the table, are they paying benefits, are they doing those types of things. And I know at the end of the day, if KKR owns this company, like they are going to be following the law. They're going to be doing, you know, at least the legal requirements. And there's some level of accountability there that you just have no idea what you're dealing with in a mom and pop type situation where maybe the owner lives in Texas, but they own a daycare in Central Oregon.
And as you look at sort of the industry now in general, like are there any fascinating trends as you look ahead and or predictions you have for where this sort of behemoth is heading? You know, it could even be like sort of some stories, like certain industries where you think that this is going to be a bigger and bigger piece here. I think, you know, one example is when we talked to Brad Hargreaves, he felt like there was going to be a massive increase in multifamily homes and, you know, multifamily residential sites, which actually, I can't remember if it was BlackRock or somebody almost immediately a week or two after announced something. So maybe Brad knew something, but is there any sort of industries or trends in how this model operates that you're keeping an eye on?
I don't know that there's anything brand new on the frontier here that would be significantly different. There are some funds that are figuring out how to scale on a smaller level and kind of bring together the synergies across regions and geographies and prior, you know, unmet industries, you know, buying a concrete companies, right? It's been family owned for 100 years, but now they're going to go buy, you know, 5 or 6 of them across the Pacific Northwest, kind of bring them under one hood. And the thinking there is, you know, you have a lot of founder-led companies. They don't have anyone to transition it to. They're getting old. They're retiring. They probably are, you know, they're still running on old POS systems, old HR management, et cetera. And it's sort of like bring them into the 21st century kind of thing is where a lot of this is happening right now. You know, the specific asset class is called search funds. It is kind of a big one on that front. I have actually seen private equity retreating from some of the things that we have seen as problematic, like emergency rooms and kind of some of the hospital stuff. I see some other areas, probably potential retreat or regulation in the senior care and manufactured housing. Those are all areas where you do not want to be optimizing for efficiency and, you know, rent-seeking type behavior. Because your consumer can't choose in those situations because they either lack capacity, because they have to make decisions too quickly, and they don't have the opportunity to actually research who they're dealing with. Like, I have no problem with private equity and childcare. I'm not thrilled with it in emergency rooms where I'm in an ambulance and I can't make a choice on where to go. And I know that they're optimizing for cost and not optimizing for the public good of keeping everybody alive, you know, no matter what the underlying circumstances. And manufactured housing is a good example of that. We're like, I don't feel great about private equity in it, where they own the pad, and the pad being the underlying dirt, and the homeowner owns the mobile home. But the frictions to transfer is so high that you can extract enormous rents from those type of people. They can't just move to a new apartment because they need to move their manufactured home, and it costs more than their manufactured home to actually move it. So then they're being charged the rents, and it's just sad, and it shouldn't be happening. I don't blame private equity. I blame the incentive structure around it.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I actually just spoke to a year ago. I was in Encinitas, California on a surf trip. And
I grew up in Encinitas.
Oh, did you? I noted there's this trailer park, I forget, across from that main sort of highway. You know where there's like that train station that they turned into a coffee shop? Across the street from there is a trailer park.
Yeah.
And I was talking to this guy who lived there for a long time. He's like this bearded guy because he had a Buffalo Bills flag outside of his trailer. And so I went up to him. I was like, hey, you're a Bills fan? And he was telling me a story. He moved there and he was stuck in exactly the situation you're talking about. I'm not sure if it was private equity, but if somebody bought this trailer park and is increasing the rents from underneath them. And he was in this difficult spot where he was trying to sell his plot of land, but he didn't own it. He was just trying to sell the rights because he had built up on top of this thing. Like, it's like more than a trailer, you know, the type, right? He's like built all this kind of stuff on top of it, and he was stuck. And I was like, who buys a trailer park? Like, you know, the thought crossed my mind. I'm curious to go back there and figure out who actually had done that.
And the vast majority of those, it's not Blackstone that owns these. It's a small investment group. They, you know, there's probably $5 or $10 million in assets under management, and they go there and they do all the things that we want to prevent. Maybe going to the housing thing, stopping massive private equity funds from owning 100,000 houses. Like, that doesn't stop this issue. Like, that's an incentive based thing that's not going to stop because we pointed out the organization that owns less than 5% of the housing stock.
Well, Matt, this was wonderful, man. It's another time I'll have to ask you why anyone would leave Encinitas, California, but that's a whole other podcast. But Bend, Oregon sounds beautiful too. Is there anything you want to plug? Anything about your firm or anything like that where we can direct our audience to?
Yeah, sure. I run the investment arm of what we do. And I think everybody heard at the beginning about how we see the alternative asset landscape and private investments. But, you know, we do a lot of other things, which is, you know, peer group networks, crowdsourcing of information, in-person meetups, and a closed confidential online forum. And so it fits a need for those who have gotten a lot of privilege and luck in their life, but still have problems nonetheless. So we're here to help.
Well, thanks for listening. And we want to bring you back on and keep talking about these kinds of things. Like, this is super helpful.
Let's do it.
And thanks for being a loyal listener.
Absolutely.
All right. I'm excited to welcome on Carrie Sun, who just wrote this wonderful memoir called Private Equity about her experience in the industry. And Carrie, first of all, thank you for being with us and congratulations on the book launch.
Thank you so much for having me today.
A couple of things to get out of the way. First of all, we will talk about a firm called Carbon. We won't really be going into the sort of ins and outs of individuals you work with, but you anonymize your experience and sort of, or pseudonymize, I don't even know how to say that word, your experience. So for people, you might like, I don't know, I've never heard of Carbon Capital. It's because you, for reasons that are probably obvious to the audience, changed the sort of names of some of the key characters and institutions here. So with that out of the way, this book is called Private Equity, but is this, you know, this was a big question I had, is were you working at a private equity firm or was it really classified as a hedge fund? And what is the difference between a hedge fund and a private equity firm?
Yeah, I worked at a fund that originally started off as a hedge fund, but over the last decade, I mean, their private equity size started approximately 2 decades ago, but a lot of hedge funds have been doing private equity, like private equity investments, usually on the venture side. And so normally, historically, one of the most popular hedge fund strategies is equity long short, usually investing in public equity markets. And hedge funds have been raising funds that also invest in, for example, venture, both early stage and later stage, a lot of later stage. And so the firm I worked at, you know, I think people still call them a hedge fund, but they, I think, prefer to be known as just a broad investment firm because they they invest in a variety of asset classes, deploying capital all over the world. And so there is some confusion. There is also overlap. A lot of the sort of traditional private equity, big, large private equity firms also have a hedge fund unit and side. And so a lot of these modern investment and financial institutions just have various ways of investing in the market. And so private equity, the title of my book, certainly does refer to that industry and asset class. The hedge fund that I worked at did do those kind of investments, but really I mean private equity in the sense of, in a more literary sense, private in the sense of the self, equity in fairness. And I really mean it as private equity self-investment. What is our private equity in ourselves? How do we invest in ourselves? How do we build our personal, financial, emotional assets over time and really allow that to live, use that to live the life we want and kind of be able to exactly structure our daily work and life in a way that feels true to ourselves?
And so, you know, and when we pick up this story with you, you are a double degree student from MIT, you graduate early. I think one of your degrees is in mathematics, one I think might be in finance. And you kind of have the world at your fingertips. You could do almost anything. And you decide to go work for, you know, this kind of big firm. That seems like a choice that might be puzzling to some of our audience, especially given what you eventually share about your experience. What was your rationale for deciding to go in this industry? Because what you were doing is, it's like, I think, quite common with people from places like MIT is to go into finance increasingly. You know, we've been for decades now reading about some of the best minds in math and science going to firms. Why do that? And also, why start the way you did, which is to be the assistant to one of the sort of key players at the firm, as you describe a billionaire who's basically running a key part of the firm?
Right. So I have to back up a little bit and just say, so I double degreed MIT in math and finance. I also have an economics minor. I graduated in 3 years. Right after that, I actually worked in quantitative equities on the investment side. So I was building stock selection models. I was on the investment side of that divide. And I was, you know, I worked at Fidelity Investments. I was there for approximately 4.5 years. And I, as I write in the book, it was a very difficult culture. This was well before Me Too, sadly. So it was very driven by a culture that made it very, very difficult for women. I'll just say that. And so, but nevertheless, you know, I was promoted quickly twice, and I had a really good career there. But I was never someone who knew exactly what she wanted to do when she grew up. I had so many, as you say, I had kind of all the possibilities in the world. You know, I could go in any number of directions, and I wasn't exactly sure which. And then after working in finance on the investment side, I realized I didn't really want to be a fund manager. I just like didn't. I saw people, my superiors above me, and I just didn't want to be them. Not that there was anything wrong with them. I just, that's not the life that I wanted for myself. You know, I'm very cognizant of time and not wasting time, not just in with respect to work, but, you know, our own selves of, you know, what are we going to do with our 4,000 weeks on Earth? And so I applied to business school. I started at Wharton. Then I thought Wharton, well, it was a joint degree program between Wharton and the School of Arts and Sciences. I was going to also get a master's MA in international relations, I think. And it was going to be a joint MBA MA in 2 years. I got there and it was a quick realization. I didn't want to work in finance after getting my MBA. And a Wharton MBA is very expensive. And so I didn't want to take on the loans and also, you know, pay the tuition and all the costs related to that. If I wasn't going to be in lucrative enough of a career after to, you know, make it worthwhile. And so I dropped out of Wharton. And then I spent a couple years taking, I will call them random classes, but there were classes that were of deep interest to me: English literature, philosophy, moral philosophy, epistemology, and creative writing. And really, I took classes in the humanities because I did not have room in my schedule to take those classes at MIT. And as I was, you know, wanting to change careers and going on this journey of self-discovery, and by the way, gaining the self-knowledge that I was trying to cultivate, and going on this journey of self-discovery turns out to be really expensive because, you know, I wasn't making any money then, but I knew I needed time and space to discover myself. And so I was burning through my savings. And in the middle of all this, a recruiter reaches out to me asking me if I want to be the right-hand person to this major hedge fund billionaire, the founder of Carbon. And, you know, I had designs on just wanting to get an MFA, be a writer, but I needed a day job. You know, I don't come from money, so there was no way to be able to support what I really wanted to do in my art, in my creative endeavors, unless I had a day job. And this kind of just actually fell into my lap.
Yeah. And you described the hiring and selection process, which I find fascinating. And I'll give you my experience, which is I have employed a bunch of people over the course of my life. And rarely when those people get hired by new places, do I get a reference call. It seems like it's gotten so rare nowadays. And I find this fascinating because some of these people, some of them have things that I would want if I were an employer, I'd want to know about. And some of them, you know, there's like a wide spectrum of performance, right? And I'm always fascinated by how do people hire somebody without ever checking a reference? The sort of standard is like 2 to 3 references or whatever. What you describe is something on a whole order of magnitude different. And I know this might seem to our audience like a detour, but I actually think it's a really important detail because the sort of tone was set before you even were selected for this position.
Yes, that's exactly it. It's actually that first chapter that I really talk about my recruiting interview and reference process. It really is, it is a complete foreshadowing of everything else that happens in the book because the tone was completely set. I mean, just for example, they asked me for my availability. I gave it to them for interviews. This is for my 14 interviews. And they chose times outside my availability. So that was a clear test of, was I willing to change around my schedule to accommodate them? Because they in no way accommodated me. And, you know, I did. And so back to your comment about references, you know, I gave the standard 2 to 3. They were my former managers and bosses and bosses' bosses at my previous places. And, you know, they said great. And then they turned around and asked for, I think it was like 10 or 11. And the other names they chose based off LinkedIn. So it was like, you know, you think you have a choice here? No, no, we're going to just tap your network. And more than anything, it wasn't like, oh, I was told by my recruiter, my potential future boss, wanted to call everyone the next day. So in addition to kind of this like little power game and negotiation that's going on, it was also a test of my, certainly it was a test of reputation, but it was also a test of my sense of urgency and resourcefulness because many people, I didn't have their numbers, you know, and had to prepare them for potentially getting a call from a random person asking for kind of a random, you know, reference. But they wanted to test my, I guess, how I performed as an employee, both with people close to me and kind of, you know, a second, third order degree reference. And, you know, yeah, it was very difficult.
Yeah. And so, you know, so they're testing you that way. They're also, I mean, it's also a smart way just to find people that they want to talk to, right? Because what people do in references is they pick the people that they are friendly with and they know will give a positive reference. So it's almost a waste of everybody's time unless you expand out the reference net. You wind up doing the interview, taking the job. There's a lot of interesting details there that people can learn about. And, you know, every step of the way, there's like in very sort of tactile ways are communicating the sort of tone you're sending you books to read. Your boss is giving you a list of 90 something responsibilities and 13 different general qualities he wants you to have and all that, which first of all, it's interesting to be like, I was reading that as somebody, you know, I was assistant early in my career to 2 different people in my field that were, I felt very lucky to be assistant to, Susan Rice when she was at the UN and David Axelrod when he was the strategist for the Obama campaign. And they're both great people. At no point did they, but they were also very demanding in ways that I could identify in your book. None of them sat me down and were like, here's your responsibilities and here are the systems and here's the book. They're just like, figure it out. So there's part of me that was like, oh, wow, okay, this is actually thoughtful that he took the time to write all these things down. And then there was another part, which is like, that's a really long list of things. And you kind of don't really editorialize too much how you felt about it. You kind of let the details speak for themselves. But I do get the sense that you do have a kind of you see it in both ways, right? I think you're in some ways, like you have a reverence for the sort of the attention to detail and excellence. And then the other times you're like, this is unreasonable also.
That's exactly what I wanted to show. And as you were saying, even, you know, just a minute or two ago, like working with people who are at the top of their game, high performers, and kind of, it's just actually, there's something so exciting and I have to say intoxicating for me. I just was so inspired really by someone who, you know, just upped the game. And I was and am continue to be a workaholic. And I wanted to be in an environment in which like people wanted to spend their day doing something they felt was meaningful to them. And working with, as you were saying, you were, you know, assistant to these very major people in your field. And I felt really the same way about this assistant job, you know? And so having nearly 100 bullet points of responsibilities, certainly, you know, some people might say that that seems crazy, but it, to me, was crazy and also really exciting. I was responsible for so much. I could see, I had visibility into so many aspects of both my boss's life and the business. And I was, you know, I was really his right-hand person because he wanted all information flow to him to come through me. So it was just, I mean, and a lot of my job was ended up being just triaging level of, you know, urgency between everything that just came into the office and would exit the office. And so ultimately, you know, I do write about my burnout from those responsibilities. But as you say, it is a two-sided thing. I was both completely mesmerized by it, you know, and I was actually totally inspired by their level of like attention to detail and also repulsed. But it is a double thing. Yeah.
I think about it as something, you know, I think for young people, there are a couple of experiences that I tend to, when I'm looking at resumes, that I tend to value a lot. One is service industry experience, like just the experience of working at a restaurant, serving people or delivering pizzas or whatever. And for reasons I won't go into, I think that's really important. I also think being an assistant is almost a rite of passage in certain ways because you, especially to people who are high performers, because you kind of get a sense how people tick. And it's also an incredibly difficult job that you could probably only do when you're young. I always admire these sort of, you know, these journeymen and women assistants who've been doing it forever. Like when I was at the UN, some of these people were career people. I'm like, I don't know how you do this for more than a couple of years. And you have like some really funny and in some cases insightful sort of scenes about what it means to be an assistant. And the one that stuck out to me was, well, first of all, the sense that you're always on call, which is something I think that's pretty obvious to people. You've ever watched Devil Wears Prada, which I think is my favorite assistant movie. You just can't, you're always waiting for something to happen. And so you can't really have a life. That's for sure. You capture that. You also capture this sort of rhythms of how do you figure this job out? It's very hard often to figure out what somebody wants. And you describe trying to go into it. This is experience I had so many times. Go into a meeting to pass a note. And how do you pass the note? And you talk about how you got the feedback that you weren't passing it confidently enough. And when do you interrupt and when do you not interrupt? And I have to say, I've been in that experience. It felt like I was going into the lion's den, to use an overused metaphor often. Yes. And sometimes it'll be with world leaders and stuff, like, and I'd be going in there and, you know, and I have to pass some note about her son or something. And it's like, I don't know whether she takes seriously whatever's going on with the son or whether this is the thing he does all the time, which is why like the first few months are hell being somebody's assistant, because you have to figure out their quirks and their nonverbals and what they take seriously and what they don't take seriously and all that. So you capture that really, really well. And so tell me, like, with that in mind, how long did it take you before you reached, like, so to use the Devil Wears Prada standard, where you reached this point where you were in rhythm, in sync with the person you're working for?
My boss actually was like, I would have these reviews, you know, he is a very structured person. And so I would have these yearly reviews and quarterly reviews, but really, I got reviewed the instant something I did something, you know, not 100% to his liking. So the example you mentioned when I, you know, interrupted the meeting and, you know, I was right to interrupt the meeting, but my energy, the way I walked was all wrong, you know? And so he was kind of a instant, constant feedback person. And so because of that, actually, just from a business standpoint, I think we were able to get in sync pretty quickly. And I think being in sync involves a lot of emotional intelligence. It was a lot of just picking up what he might prioritize and, you know, something over another thing, which is why, you know, I don't know why my brain just went here, not to bring in AI into the conversation, into every conversation. But I think about whether roles, like literally like my role could be at risk because of AI. And I think about this a lot, you know, especially with my math background. And Ravi, you were just talking about getting in sync. Now, it is just so difficult to model situations mathematically because like every situation was kind of a unique situation. You would need to have a heuristic or something, but it's nearly impossible mathematically. Now, this is not a challenge to mathematicians out there, but to model the situation, because every day was entirely different. My role was responding to him, and he responded to the markets, to news. Every day was entirely different. Now, I wonder, I have a question for you, Ravi, and if you felt that was the way in politics, but you know, just give the example you use, like meeting with world leaders. Do you interrupt a meeting with world leaders with minor emergency about your boss's child? Now, in order to model that, you know, that situation would have needed to come up many times before with similar world leaders, with similar situations for the child at a similar age. And it's just like, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is every situation was unique that called for extreme attention to the different factors that would matter to your boss, who's this, you know, unique individual with very unique values and worldviews. And so it was a constant, you know, it was definitely laborious in terms of just like being on call all the time, certainly the hours, but also that there was a lot of emotional labor there to make that judgment call. And you have to make these judgment calls in like 5 seconds. You know, and that's the pace.
Yeah. And I think people don't understand the scale of some of the stuff. You know, when I was working for Susan Rice, for example, I was the sort of head of like a team of 5 assistants. It was like an insane amount of people involved. And that's part of the skill too, is like, how do you leverage this team of people to get things done? And people might be like, that's excessive and all that. But you have to realize in that situation, she's scheduled all day. She's going back and forth between New York and DC. She's on the National Security Council. We're dealing with classified information. We had a separate person whose job in each city was just to handle the classified part of her schedule. So it's like, it was wild. But I think of when I left, she was so mean to me at first in ways that I look back and I'm almost like grateful for the experience, because I was like a entitled, overconfident young man. And she definitely disabused me of that really quickly. I remember one day she was like, we were in some big meeting with like all the senior people at the State Department. And she asked me something substantive. Every once in a while, she'd ask me something substantive and I would never be prepared for it, because my job was everything but that, for at first at least. And I just didn't have an answer, of course, because I was like trying to survive. And she goes, what do you even do here in front of everybody? And I was just like, oh my God,
this is the worst day
of my life. But over time, you cross this threshold and it becomes almost like a high where you're like, I now am indispensable. And to these people, one of my pieces of advice to these powerful people is like, if you were just 25% less demanding and nicer to the people around you, you'd have a couple of extra years with those people.
Exactly.
And it would be so much more valuable to you than have to keep retraining like the next version of me to do that job, you know?
Completely. I totally agree. It is. That's kind of one of the main themes of my book is just, can we improve the situation? You know, because it was a high, and that's why I was, you know, there, even though I was so burnt out. I had physical ramifications, you know, emotional health issues, but you know, if we can just improve it by, as you say, 25%, then it's really costly to lose employees. And to lose employees, especially if, you know, the manager and his or her assistant was totally in sync. Like, we were totally in sync for a while. And also to your comment about having a team of assistants, that the kind of just pure work situation that led me to leave was I asked for help, and I just asked for more help. I wanted an assistant to help me. And for whatever reason, and you know, ultimately, I think it just is not financial, because I would see my boss making huge financial decisions to invest in companies, you know, millions of dollars in an hour, you know, and I asked him for help, you know, I'm just making up numbers. Like, let's say the assistant just gets paid $100,000. It's still just way less of a decision than, you know, like, you know, he makes regularly. And he just could not do that for me. And I could not survive anymore, because as you say, in the beginning, it is purely about survival. And I never reached a point where, I suppose I shouldn't be shocked at some of our parallel experiences, but after a while, once you're in sync, the really fun part is getting to be involved with more and more, not just responsibilities, but like bigger responsibilities. And
yeah,
just,
it's like, a superpower.
It's a superpower. Yeah.
Well, people start to resent you. Like when I was at the UN, like people would, I now realize it now because I wasn't sophisticated enough at the time, but I started to receive a lot of animus because I was a gatekeeper to her and I had such a close relationship with her. And often I didn't really even realize the power of that. Like just a one-off comment. Like there's this guy who is like, who used to run the budget office. And sorry if he's listening, I apologize. I think his name is Bruce. I'm sorry, Bruce. But Bruce did something, I forget what it was, but I was 20-something years old. So I would like get in the elevator with Susan and I'd like start shit-talking Bruce. Now I didn't know. I was just like a kid. I'd be like, oh, that was ridiculous. She'd be like, yeah, but that's like a huge power.
It's a huge power.
And then she would like rail on Bruce in the next meeting. And I'd be like, uh-oh. This is actually exactly. Like a real responsibility I have, you know?
Well, it's a real responsibility and like you have her ear, you know? And she like really listens to you because she trusts your judgment. And it's just so, it's when it works, it's such a fantastic working relationship, you know? And so again, to your point, like actually in this job, I won't say who in which positions, I was given the advice by more than one person who, of various levels of seniority and who've been there a long time to actually downplay the closeness of our relationship.
Yes.
For my survival. And so I just was like heads down, work, work, work. And of course, that's not a good strategy either. But yeah, exactly. It can actually, you know, backfire.
And you know, the key here is, and I think people are listening, especially young people, about how to like take these jobs and make them substantive, right? Like, I think what happens is if you earn your way, and this is true, not even as just assistant jobs to a person, but let's say you're a finance assistant or you're an associate salesperson or whatever. It's like when you show that you're capable of handling the smaller details, they give you more. So like for me, I started doing speech writing. That was my first speech writing job because one thing she realized was I saw all these people that she was interacting with. And so we would do this town hall once a month for all the employees at the embassy. And I would write the speech for her, and it would be, I would think, like basically she'd be shouting people out and thanking them for their work over the past month. And so what that wound up doing was twofold. One was I started to write speeches, and then that eventually turned into Security Council speeches and things like that, which was a huge professional step for me. But also it smoothed over a lot of the sort of resentments that could have bubbled up because people saw me and they weren't stupid. They knew where those talking points were coming from. So people knew, okay, like he's got your back. Like if he's actually going out of his way to be nice to the different sort of Bruces of the world who are constantly ducking and covering. But these are things that take time. And again, like your book underscored to me how short-sighted some of these people can be. And their perfectionism sometimes could kill them, you know?
Right.
Some of these jobs.
I love that because, you know, in addition to being just overall assistant, right-hand person, and the sole assistant to this person.
That's
and
wild. By the way, I can't even believe that.
Yeah. Not only was I the sole assistant, I also supported someone else, his analyst. So my time was also split between two people. It was actually totally insane. But on top of that, I thought I was also, you know, I think a job that was, you know, actually not in the 100 bullet points of responsibilities. I was his communications manager, as in like I also wrote his speeches that he would give to the firm or just like everything from like holiday party, you know, toast talks, who to thank, exactly as you say.
Very stressful.
Call
stressful.
Out to Bruce, like who do you leave out? Who do you
By the
like
way, it's
mention?
Pronunciations. Like it's every little thing. Like you said to think about like I'm doing this narrative podcast now with another company and I was like having a mild freak out the other day because they didn't do the pronunciations right. And I was yes. I was like, oh my God, I'm the guy now. I did it.
yes. And that's on you. Yeah. You have to like prepare fully, you know, and not just, you know, write the speeches, but also, you know, kind of also give them markers on like when to pause, yeah, exactly. So all of that. And more than speeches, you know, I did all of his presentations for just a ton of work.
It's also great skills, but also an impossible load for anybody to carry, especially when the standards are very high.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to your experience to, you know, like on this topic. So like in my book, I'm trying to show, you know, The Devil Wears Prada is also one of my favorite movies. And But, you know, like my former boss, well, one, I still respect him so much, even today. But he never yelled at me. He never actually made me cry. He was just extremely, extremely, extremely demanding and unrelenting about his demands, such that I think the job was actually impossible. But, you know, so on the surface, he's, quote, nice, right? Like, as in, like, he spoke complete sentences usually and calmly. And, but, you know, he didn't throw phones at me. He didn't, you know, ever just, so, you know, even managers and, you know, these major figures who have really, really resourceful, high level assistants, which it sounds like you were absolutely as well. And this niceness is, I don't think it's necessarily a veneer, but I'm just saying that even when a boss doesn't cross the line in some ways of like the typical horrible boss, you know, behavior, the relationship between a boss and his, you know, his or her assistant can still be just extremely difficult structurally because of the job. And
for sure.
Yeah.
I actually avoid her. I just realized this as we're talking. I avoid her till this day. It hadn't even occurred to me until you just said that. That's funny. Like, I don't ask her for favors or anything like that. In part, it's just like such a hard to explain relationship. She would do me the favor if I asked, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it's like, I just have this weird relationship. I can't even describe it. And she probably wouldn't, she'd be surprised to hear me say that. We did not even scratch the surface of this book, which I actually think is great because I want our audience to go out and read it. I did not anticipate we would deep dive into the role of assistant, but actually something that means a lot to me and I know to you. So actually, what a fun segue. This book is great. Go out there and get it wherever you get your books. It's called Private Equity by Carrie Sun. And there's just a lot of details like this in there. And I think I love books that really drill in on the details and then make the sort of larger claims from those details. And you do both so eloquently. And I'm excited that you're finally giving oxygen to your budding writing career. What a debut, Carrie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening again right now, if you can. Go on your computer, click the link in the show notes, or go to the Webby website. Vote for us in limited series and specials in news and politics for the unbiased history of Israel and Palestine. It would mean so much to us. And we'll be back here on Thursday. Thank you very much, everybody.